And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. We're coming at you one day late because I was busy. And This is Phil Lairness, and in Detroit, I almost said down under, but it's been a long, long time since you were down under. You are stateside, if we consider Michigan part of the United States.
If we do, or part of the UP. I was up in the UP.
Oh, the peninsula, were you?
I was.
And you would think that if we did consider, by the way, Michigan part of the United States, oh, I don't know, we'd do something about getting people in Flint clean water. But
yeah, we're working on that.
That's my political opening salvo for the for the show. This is Dean Haglund, the Motor City Madman. Tell me about the peninsula, Dean. What were you doing there?
Oh, my gosh. It was... I was in Houghton in the Upper Peninsula for Geek Up, a very small, lovely third year of doing a science fiction pop culture fest. It was me and the voice of Zelda from the video game Zelda, the Princess Zelda, Patricia Somerset. We had a lovely time, laughs aplenty. People came.
And, I would imagine a beautiful part of the world, too.
Holy smokes, beautiful. And, you know, when you think about the Klondike and that, you know, $1 billion worth of minerals went through there. This is copper country up there. And $8 billion worth of minerals have come through that neighborhood up there. And so I stayed at a bed and breakfast. So beautiful, where Teddy Roosevelt also stayed. So I slept in the bed that Teddy Roosevelt once slept in. And the main breakfast room had elephant hide wallpaper. Have you ever heard of such a thing? The wallpaper made of elephant skin from 1908.
Please tell me that the name of the Teddy Roosevelt room in the bed and breakfast is called Sleep Softly and Carry a Big Stick.
No, it's not. It's just room number one. But it should be Sleep Softly and Carry a Stick. That's a good one.
So at the opening of the day's show, a little special riff on our usual opening with some of the Cars, the musical delights of the Cars, who were at a time this kid's favorite extant band. I don't think even in the early 80s they had probably supplanted the Beatles for me, but in terms of ongoing acts, they were probably number one for a couple of maybe only a summer, but early 80s. I mean, I remember on my Walkman, playing a cassette tape of I guess it would be the Cars and then Candy O on the other side, and you know it would auto flip. And so the tape would just play over and over and over again. One summer when I wrote my first screenplay, back when I was probably like 14 years of age.
Wow. Yeah. You were listening to the Cars.
So I guess that brings us to celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Why don't we start with Brian Turk? Now, Brian Turk was a 49-year-old actor. Did you ever watch the HBO series Carnival?
I did a little bit. Yes, absolutely. Who was he in that?
He played Gabriel, the strong man?
Oh, yeah. Sure he did.
I want to like, I mean, I watched an episode or two of that when it came out, and I love so many members of the cast of that show, and I love the atmosphere, and for whatever reason, I didn't continue with it. Are you saying that it's out?
Well, I certainly love the production values, and the acting was spectacular, but I think it's one of those things where it always sat on the cusp of being canceled or not being canceled. So the writers were always writing just to the edge of potentially maybe having another show or maybe having the whole circus pack up and go away. So as I recall, you're sure to do well with the first six, and then it gets weird from there on in. Okay. It was all weird. I mean, yeah, it was a weird turn of the century circus in the desert, but yeah, there was some writing challenges.
It's interesting that when you said they had to be prepared to, you know, pack up the circus for the circus to pack up and go away, I truly did not know whether you meant the circus in the show or you were referring metaphorically to a show,
I know, right?
A show being canceled. Yeah.
Well, and I think there is metaphor all through Carnival that applies itself to a lot of Hollywood living. So
Brian Turk, now this is the thing, his other major credits, I guess his first major role came in 94 when he played Spike on Saved by the Bell, The New Class, a show I know you loved because you were hungover a lot. And I don't know what that means. He appeared as Tiny on two episodes of Beverly Hills 90210. So I love that he goes, that's range. He goes from Tiny on 90210 to the strong man on Carnival.
Yeah.
And his other credits include 2 1/2 Men and American Pie 2. So this is the thing about Brian Turk is this legacy of being this youthful performer. And then it's stunning to read dead at the age of 49 from cancer. It's like, how does that kid now, that's all ridiculously soon, and he survived by his wife and 8-year-old son. So Brian Turk. Ann Rivers Siddons, Dean. Is Ann Rivers Siddons in regular rotation in your book club?
I don't know. No. Give me a little more on that.
Well, and then you need to give me a little more on your book club because I was unaware. She was the best-selling author of such novels as 1988's Peachtree Road, Atlanta-based story that none other than Pat Conroy called the Southern novel for our generations. Her work focused on the South throughout her career. She wrote 19 novels set in and around her Georgia hometown. Her debut novel, Heartbreak Hotel, was adapted into the 1989 feature film Heart of Dixie.
Oh.
She followed it with the 1978 horror novel The House Next Door, which, of course, Stephen King was a big champion of. He called it one of the best horror novels of the 20th century. Her other novels include Home Place, Sweetwater Creek, and her most recent in 2014, The Girls of August. She died in one of my favorite places, historic Chucktown, Charlestown, South Carolina, of lung cancer at the age of 83.
Wow.
And before I let go of the horror House Next Door, Dean, I'm going to a birthday party on October 5th for a friend and for a friend's wife, who and the party is being thrown at the house into which they are about to move. So it's going to be empty when we
pre-housewarm.
Exactly. And
I like it.
So an October housewarming birthday party in one of the restored Carroll Ave Victorian homes in Los Angeles, the biggest collection of Victorians west of the Mississippi, and the actual house that was the site of Salem's Lot.
Wow. Look at you getting scared.
Wait, I should be scared?
Oh, didn't I tell you?
Oh, God. All right. You're coming with me. All right. Jeff Fenholt, Dean, starred in the original Jesus Christ Superstar on Broadway. Creates the title role on Broadway. He didn't create the title role. That was Jesus Christ, I guess.
It's based on a true story.
The show, you may have known this, the show originated as a concept album with Deep Purple singer Ian Gillan, singing the part of Jesus. And then Fenholt took over the role for the show's 1971 live debut and continued for its 2-year Broadway run.
Oh, you know what? I did not know that. You'd think I would know that, but I did not know that. That's a new thing I knew. Deep Purple.
Yeah. I mean, a concept album. That's interesting.
That's really
interesting. I guess that's like Sgt. Pepper's, you know, like as a kid, you listen to the Sgt. Pepper's. This is my second Beatles reference. You listen to Sgt. Pepper's as a kid and you go, okay, I want to see the show now. I want to see this show that this album is presenting. And if you're unlucky, as I was, you're led to the Bee Gees movie. It wasn't the album was not a template, as it turns out, for a show. It was pretending. Okay. What else do we know about Fenholt? We know his career stalled after Jesus Christ Superstar. And you know, there is a history, by the way, of people playing Christ or Christ-like figures, and for whatever reason, their careers just kind of hitting the skids. I mean, as if maybe this messed with them in some way. He struggled with substance abuse following the role, following the performance. He would later convert to Christianity to help overcome his addictions. Well, the answer was right there in front of him all along, wasn't it?
All along. He should have just. Right?
He became an evangelist, frequently appearing on Christian Network TBN. He also had a recording career, releasing several albums and singles. It seems to me he cut out that middle period and just gone straight into that after Jesus Christ Superstar. But I was not managing him. Anyway, Mr. Fenholt died at the age of 68. And so we are moving into the musical realm from Broadway musical legend, I think we can say. I mean, if you iconically create that role of Jesus Christ Superstar, you are a Broadway legend, my friend.
Right.
And we go right back into another story of my youth. So when I'm in high school, a bunch of my classmates who are on the, I guess, probably the senior class committee or our office holders, we all go to Berkeley, California, to home of UCB, not the Upright Citizens Brigade, home of UC Berkeley, for a battle of the bands that we can pick the bands that are going to be performing at our school functions through the year. This is how, you know, they would get hired for the proms and bar mitzvahs in the area.
Okay.
And the big centerpiece performance to lure everybody in. If you come for the Battle of the Bands, you get to stay for a 2 or 3 song set from Eddie Money. So that's my brush with Eddie Money greatness. He was a fixture in the Bay Area, of course, a popular rocker, had a string of hits in the 70s and 80s, including the anthems Two Tickets to Paradise, Shaken, and Take Me Home Tonight. And I believe I just listed what his set was at that Battle of the Bands.
I bet it was. How could it not be?
He was born Eddie Mahoney in Brooklyn, New York, worked the club circuit in California, was noticed by Columbia Records, who signed him to a contract. His success was boosted when MTV became a sensation because of his humorous videos for Think I'm in Love. Well, that was a good song. I forgot about that. And Shaken. He also acted appearing in the sitcom The King of Queens. That I did not know. And he was currently starring in a reality show. Did you know this?
No.
Called
I'm off on my reality show.
Called Real Money.
Really?
Yeah. So he continued to record albums and tour as recently as this year. Did you know that?
No. I've been you know, moving around the world a bit. So
look, I'm not gonna lie. His music career kind of, for me, started and ended with a certain battle of the bands back in anyway. He died at 70 from esophageal cancer. Cancer. A lot of cancer on this show. My God. But he was one of those rockers that, I mean, I was never a fan in that I didn't collect his music, but his songs would come on, you knew them, you liked them, and he certainly seemed like a fun personality who was enjoying being Eddie Money, and what the hell else is there for you, really?
Exactly. What the hell else is there?
Okay. Rick Ocasek. That brings us to the big headliner today. Yeah, I mean, so much about his death is shocking to me, Dean.
Really?
Yes. Now, he was the lead singer, songwriter, and rhythm guitarist of the Cars, who, yes, they had a string of hits in the 70s and 80s, including Drive, Just What I Needed, Shake It Up. I'm going to say this about the Cars. They're one of the best bands ever to become so popular. And when they became so popular, they also stopped being such a great band. But I mean, they changed things. I mean, they are seminal new wave influence.
Right.
And so it is hard to really express just how cool they were. And unique, you know, it's, I say this about disco, a lot, that, you know, there was this time now disco, everybody loves disco. Oh, I always loved disco. I always loved disco. And it's like, wait a minute. Some of you have to be the people who were yelling disco sucks and were spray painting disco underneath the word stop on stop signs everywhere. You have to be, because everybody turned on that genre so fast.
And within 2 months, I would say.
And they turned on it because that sound could be so easily replicated. And the easy replication tended to belie the truth, which is the people who created the genre, who were the pioneers of the genre, I maintain would have been successful no matter any era into which they were born, because they were truly talented. It's just that the sound that became crystallized as disco, again, could be so easily recreated. And to a lesser degree, I feel that New Wave had a bit of that problem, because so much of it was based on synthesizer programming.
Right. Yes, it was the we went from the Moog synthesizer to the Korg to then the Yamaha D7 around that time. And then you had the drum machine and the electric drums that had those weird sounding boops and high pitched beady boo, all that stuff. So, yeah, music suddenly took a turn from resonant woods and skins to suddenly there was a digital outload.
Please.
And that was 8-bit to 16-bit, right? I mean, that was the other thing.
Please tell me. That the name of the bed and breakfast that you stayed at was Resident Woods and Skins. That for Teddy Roosevelt, that would have been spectacular. I can't let go of this. I've got a whole reality show I'm authoring, which is you sleeping in beds where presidents have slept.
I know. I've slept in two now, right? Lyndon B. Johnson out in Benigni's Ranch. That was Lyndon B. Johnson's bedroom in their house. And now I slept in the bed of Teddy Roosevelt. That's quite a bucket list now, to try and get all 49.
And 45. We have 45. Oh. But Yeah, and it ends, like, the final episode. When you know it's time to pack up the circus, the final episode is, and the bed is still warm, and the president's still in it.
He's still in it. Womp, womp.
Yeah, getting peed on by Russian hookers. Okay, so, allegedly. Yeah, so, okay, sick. So here's the thing. Here's why I say that it's kind of shocking on many levels for me. He forms the Cars in Boston with a longtime bandmate Benjamin Orr under various names, and I don't know if this is true because there are so many repackaging of songs and retrospectives and unreleased material that a popular band has as part of their legacy now, even after they break up, right? But right. I remember when I was following them and getting their new records that it was a hard and fast rule that if their album had a depiction of a woman on the cover, not necessarily photographic, it could have been art, like, you know, Candy O. If it had a picture of a woman on the cover, it was a hit. Their albums that did not have a woman on the cover did not sell well. Okay, but that's not part of the legacy of Rick Ocasek. Anyway, they played bands under different names. Played their first shows as the Cars in 1976. By 1978, they were stars with hit singles from their debut album, including Just What I Needed, My Best Friend's Girl, and Good Times Roll. Okay. But here's the deal. So he dies at 75, which means he's 32 before the Cars even play a gig. He's 34 when they have their first hit. He's a mature guy with a kind of a full career of music already behind him. When you think about music being so much, and rock and roll being such a young man's game, right? He's 32, 34. So when Heartbreak City comes out in 84 and sells like gangbusters, right? Breaks records, number one album. Their popularity skyrocketing, which such songs off that album as Since You're Gone, which we played at the outset, Magic. A massive success. And the video for their lead single, You Might Think, became the first video of the year at the MTV Video Music Awards. They were the first to really turn video into a fun video funhouse is what it was for them with their videos. But anyway, he's 40 when doing that. And that's mind-blowing to me. Like, this seminal figure of new wave hitting his peak, he's 40. And at that time, especially, I as a kid, you just don't wrap your head around the idea that, oh, yeah, rock and roll, that's for people in their 40s.
Right?
That's not what we thought when we were kids. I mean, I was aware of, the Rolling Stones were in their 40s at that time.
Right.
But not the hottest, current, most meaningful band is in their 40s. So anyway, so that was stunning for me to think about. Anyway, dies at his home in New York City at the age of 75. I didn't look this up, but I do know, of course, he was married to the fabulous supermodel Paulina Poroskova.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, they stayed married all those many years. But
do I look this up?
Well, I'm surprised there wasn't anything about it in the Teddy Roosevelt room.
Yeah, they sort of leave that stuff out. I don't know why.
Well, we have our crack team of researchers that can get us the information later in the show. We spent a lot more time with the celebrity deaths than I had intended, but it was kind of interesting.
In May 2018, she announced that they had separated a year earlier.
So. Oh, no.
Yeah.
May 2018. Wait for it. Heartbreak City.
Yeah. Oh, ding a ding.
And maybe that's what kills him. You don't lose your lifelong partner and then walk away from it unscathed. That's a tough thing. And it gets tougher and tougher in modern life, again, as we talked about last week, right? We're so isolated by technology. And we were talking about empathy and the collective grieving, the importance of it being a collective process last week. And I was thinking about how we watch movies now.
Yes.
You know, that so much of it, removing that communal process of it.
I know, right?
And how movies don't affect us the same way in what I think was a positive way. You know, our feeling for our fellow man and our community and losing that. I mean, I always thought of how we've lost kind of the sacred aspect of movies with the, you know, the grand presentation of it, but just the communal aspect of it, how important that was. And I also,
you know, the question was put to me, why should we care about silent film comedies was the question. Why should we care? And I said, you know, it is something to watch in a packed movie house, a silent comedy, because the laughter is 10 times louder and more cathartic than anything where you're watching, you laugh at something Jim Carrey says, but then you have to shut up to hear the next thing somebody says, or you lose it, right? I think about seeing Tootsie and how I didn't hear half of the dialogue because people were laughing so hard at that thing, and it sort of ruined the movie experience. I didn't, you know, the laughters fell off because you couldn't hear what the plot was. So when you see a silent film and you have a room full of constant laughter, I'm thinking of Safety Last with Harold Lloyd. That is nonstop laughter, literally, because it rolls from one visual gag to the next visual gag, almost with psychic timing of how the laughs are rolling. So it's hard to explain that to someone who's never experienced it, but it's a thing.
There's two different elements of this that let's start with the comedy first and then move into silent, because as we know, comedy in movies, big screen movies especially, has fallen on hard times.
Right.
You know, what comedies get released to theaters? And part of the problem, we've talked about so many of the problems, but part of the problem I started noticing developing when you make a comedy and executives go and watch it alone in screening rooms, or they then, with the advent of video, they watch it on a screener. And it's, you know, and filmmakers, God bless their hearts, would suggest you should see it with an audience. And they would say, I don't need to see something with an audience to know that it's funny. Okay.
Right.
And maybe that's true. But I the purpose of being with an audience wasn't about getting you to laugh. It was about collective energy.
Right.
It was about you being buoyed along on this sea of goodwill that is being created, and to experience it, not to say whether or not something is funny. That's, we don't, you know, comedy is not, we don't use the word funny for comedy. Comedy is something more than something being funny. Comedy isn't the joke. Comedy is the mood and the energy and the world that's created.
Right.
And
the situation. There's situation comedies.
And you better enter and experience, or maybe only enter and experience the world through a world of communal energy that's created. I don't know how to really put it, but I mean, because you're right, the joke, if a joke is funny, a joke is funny. But it's not necessarily going to alter your energy that much or affect your emotion that much. The collective of it. Because comedy, no less than tragedy, can create catharsis of its own. But it can only do that through a collective experience.
And this is hard to explain for people who have only stuck their head on the screen and only experienced, you know, video games and Minecraft and that sort of thing. They say I do have a collective experience. I wear a headset. I'm talking to some guy in Scotland while we're shooting digital monsters.
Right.
And you're like,
right.
Yeah.
It's a collective mediated experience. And as we got back to last week, different parts of your brain are being activated.
Right.
They are not the empathic center. They are not the communal center. And this idea of silent, Dean, silent comedy. Why should I care? I want to move just away from the realm of cinema because, yeah, we could also make arguments about, well, do you like movies? Well, then, you know, because that question is so lazy, why should I care? It's like, well, why should I care about anything that came before the thing I enjoyed?
Right.
Well, maybe you don't have to. Maybe you don't have to. There is no should. The truth is, though, that if you actually love something, then you do care, or a person, you care about what formed them, what built them, what led to them. You care about it. You have an affection for it, and learning about it deepens your connection and affection for that person, that place,
right,
that thing. You might love the city you live in right now. You won't love it less by learning more about its past. The present will resonate greater with you. So there is always that, the question is lazy, but at the same time, I get it. Okay. Why do I care about this? It's a different form. I don't need to see it to appreciate what I'm watching now. But there's something about this idea, especially of silent comedy. I think more than ever now, people ought to care. Because
yeah.
It takes us away from the verbal, the written, and into a universal that all people can speak. This idea that you don't need to be brought together by language to enjoy yourselves.
Yes. And at a time where the cultural shift is so extreme. Well, that's extreme. We've just had a seismic shift sociologically in that talking to my improv students, some of them couldn't watch the Dave Chappelle comedy special. It was just, they had to turn it off. And I was taken aback by that. They said it was just too harsh. And Bill Burr and Paper Tiger at the thing, and then the news today, the new cast member from SNL fired in 4 days because all of his terrible racist and homophobic comedy that had been recorded on podcasts came to light. So nobody vetted the comic. So we live in this time where comedy is now very specific to your taste, as opposed to silent comedies, which are universal in their appeal and in their relatability, frankly. So
think about a moment of silence. If you've ever been to a big show and for whatever reason they've held a moment of silence for someone. When you are in a big collection of people, a moment of silence is so full of energy.
Yeah.
It's
powerful.
The silence is powerful, and it, you know why it's powerful? Because it's full of all possibilities.
Right.
And people who can explore those possibilities without the need for words. It's spectacular. It's the reason, and we don't pay attention to it because we don't pay attention to our bodies as existing primarily as patterns of energy, but it's why a certain person can walk into the room and our mood can change so dramatically for the positive or for the negative, right?
Right.
Because we are beings of energy, and when different energy fields interact with ours, the harmonic frequencies get affected, the resonance changes our experience of it changes. So this is why silent film, because if nothing else, it's a classroom for how we actually walk through the world. That you can be and take delight in your fellow human beings and the joy that they're bringing without saying a single goddamn thing.
Right. So, you know, I think we're coming to a time where the silent film will be the thing that we go back to. Much like the plane ride from Kuala Lumpur to Dhaka, Bangladesh, where the in-flight movie was a Chaplin movie because there were 65 dialects of different languages all in one country that some couldn't even speak to their fellow passenger, even though they were all going to the same tiny country. So,
So I was also thinking about just in my life, specifically on me, instead of decrying, okay, what collectively we've lost. I used to, when I wanted to track down movies, great movies, and wanted to see them on the big screen, think especially pre-DVD, right? Before the presentation even started to get decent and our televisions started to get big enough to warrant it, right? If it was a great movie, I needed to see it on screen. So then I would need to track it down. Fortunately, Los Angeles is one of the reasons we come here. You know, if you love movies, it's a chance to really an opportunity to be able to study movies and its history, where they're made, how they're made, but also get to see them presented on the big screen. But the act of tracking them down, I might get to travel to a part of town that I didn't know. And in the process of going to see these movies, I was meeting other people who were kindred spirits in some way. And sometimes I would talk to them and meet people. But at the very least, I'm sharing a passion with them. And let's not forget that passion is so derived because it's passing ions. You are exchanging energy. And this process of going to these things, of passing ions with people, of getting to see parts of a town that I didn't know and learn about its history a little bit, opened me up in such ways. Plus, the act of getting to these things, you are putting skin in the game. You are invested in them. You're already emotionally and physically activated. All of that is lacking from what it means to seek out a great movie. Now I have to type a few keys on my computer.
Yeah, there it is.
And dial it up. And then the other thing about it is, as I've said before, if things become immediately available, then they also become, to a degree, immediately disposable. And why spend time involved in easily disposable activities? Isn't your time more valuable than that? But instead, we've got this idea of, oh, my time's too valuable for me to invest myself in my activities.
Right.
And which is so strange, because what you are also then basically arguing is that you yourself are disposable. And finally, there's this I had to realize, that finding and catching up and filling in my education on certain types of movies or certain national cinemas or the movies of a certain actor or director or era was such an exciting exploration. And now, because I have easy availability to all of it and there's so much of it, it's become a stressful to-do list.
Ugh.
It adds to my stress because the experience... Even if I love the movie, and sometimes I do, but the experience isn't transporting, it isn't transformational, because I don't have that much invested in it.
Interesting. And sad.
And sad. And so a fun segue into some movies that are upcoming. Talked about it a little bit, I think, one of these last week. But I'm struck by how this month we've got two sequel slash remakes coming out you know, movies that live in the same universe as other movies. One overtly so, Dr. Sleep, the sequel to The Shining. It was written as a novel by Stephen King as a sequel to his novel, The Shining. He has, in the years since he's become sober, learned to actually think that the Kubrick version of The Shining is a great, great movie. You know, he hated it because they changed things. And as he said, because he was a mean alcoholic.
Right.
And I'm shocked that a mean alcoholic would have a problem with the horror movie that Kubrick made about the horrors of alcoholism. but the director of the sequel, the writer-director of Dr. Sleep, the movie, has made it be both a sequel to the novel and to the original movie. And has kind of figured out how to bridge the gap between the two and solve the problems, supposedly.
Oh, neat. That's fine.
And so we truly are revisiting the original world. I mean, the climax of the film involves Danny, now grown up, played by Ewan McGregor, needing to revisit the Overlook. And they've recreated the Overlook from the original movie completely. And when you watch the trailer, you know, you're blown away. Now, I'm not saying that this is going to be a great movie. It does worry me that the trailer at times is, oh my God, that's great. But when you pull back and you realize, oh, the only times the trailer is great is when it's showing the original movie or is revisiting the original movie, the new stuff looks really, really flat. But I am struck by this coming out within weeks of The Joker. Now, we know that The Joker is a DC universe film, an origin story of the arch villain, the Joker. But it is, as we were talking about a bit last week, it is set unofficially in the same universe as King of Comedy. It's set in the early 80s. Robert De Niro is playing a winking version of his character from King of Comedy. He was willing to make it be overt, but they were never going to get the rights figured out. The movie is a pastiche of Scorsese tropes and tributes. In the trailer, you see the scene from Taxi Driver. You see King of Comedy. You see you know, his other movies. But the point is that it's really trying to capture a certain era of America, but also a certain era of movie going. And so that's what I'm struck by, is the two movies that people are so excited by are in no small part about the lost art of movie going.
Wow. Really?
Because they're both revisiting 1980, 1981. They're both revisiting right before VHS. And how everything changes with that. And of course, these are filmmakers that grew up loving movies from that era, the great movies of the 70s and the popular movies of the 80s. But it's so interesting because are young people interested in these movies at all? I don't know. Maybe they'll get them out for Joker, maybe a date night because it's a horror film. But it is interesting that these are really about a long gone way of enjoying storytelling.
Huh. That's fascinating. Now, you know, I was 50-50 on seeing that thing, but now that you say that's a revolving thematic metaphor, maybe I might go check this out.
Well, you kind of have to, Dean, if I may, see both. I mean, I said earlier there is no should, but
now I should.
But again, the one is overtly a remake and a sequel set in the same universe as the original based on a horror book from the 70s. Are you seeing why I'm saying you need to go? Because if rumor has it, we're working on a certain project that it could help.
Right.
Okay.
Fantastic.
So, and then the other one is a movie that, at least through the trailer, if you watch the full trailer that dropped last week, Joker, seems to be a movie about the origin and evolution of the comedy of hate.
Yes, right?
So again, for C reason before...
C reason above, yes, the comedy of hate.
You have homework, I'm saying.
I'm hearing that. I'm on it. Here I go. Look at me go.
Now, I don't know why I guess just apropos of De Niro, I'm starting to realize that I saw De Niro at the Alec Baldwin celebrity roast on Comedy Central.
And
first of all, I'm struck by apparently De Niro is from that era where when you get old, you become tiny. And De Niro was never the biggest guy, right? I mean, so smaller guys make movie stars, as we know. But oh my God, he's tiny. He's elf like in his dotage. But oh my God, yeah, so old. And I'm just struck by it because the Irishman trailer, the Joker trailer, and the de-aging of him. So good, Dean, because it's not that far removed from the image we have of De Niro.
I think that's the future of deep fake, right? I mean, Google is desperately working to have some sort of software to let you know when something's been digitally altered that you're watching, so that you are not fooled by images that are still to cause panic or to slander or libel or whatever. But yeah, we every year at all the E3s and stuff, you saw this technology going that way. And it's, a mad gallop to an artificial, completely artificial movie scape that we will watch in the future.
Do you know, maybe we will see a return to some old Hollywood in the sense that think of starlets, right? Like the kind of lighting with the gauzy lighting and
key hair light.
Yeah, exactly. The soft focus and to make them, look so lustrous and young and mysterious and all the different, looks that they could achieve through,
right.
Through the
Vaseline
right
lens.
Yeah. And, please tell me the name of the room you stayed in at the bed and breakfast was called Vaseline on the Lens. Anyway, But I was thinking about this, right? So as the years go on, and then the other thing about that era of Hollywood stardom was that there was a mystery to the stars, right? Because you weren't seeing them all the time in public appearances. There weren't reality shows. There wasn't 24/7 coverage of stories. There were fanzines, but you rarely saw these people in public in any way, right?
Which is why, the red carpet was an exciting time. This was their one chance to see one of these rare sightings, which aren't rare anymore.
And so the mystery of it is so important for an actor, for a star, right? And and now totally different. Now as stars, they have to so engage in all the various media platforms, be present in it, so that they can continue to be a brand name that then will get big movies. All right.
Right.
And as women, unfortunately, what we know through the years, and men as well, but this push, this pressure almost to actually alter themselves to try to artificially stay younger than they are. And and look, you can look however you want to do. You can do whatever you want to do. It's just it can also be unhealthy and it can also be an external pressure. And for actors, it's so disappointing because you look at some of these people and you go, oh, my God, I wanted to see how they aged. They were getting more and more beautiful and now they can't move their face.
Right.
And also they're denying themselves important tools as actors. And it's so distressing and disappointing. But maybe we're moving back because deep fake and other technologies can actually take, like, you no one has ever replaced Julia Roberts as a major draw in romantic comedies. All right, well, cast Julia Roberts then, and you can deep fake your way to a younger Julia Roberts. And the only problem comes when then people in life go, oh, I don't want to go see her. Have you seen how she looks in real life? Blah, 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 blah. So now the great news is you get to stay mysterious in real life.
Right? Yeah, you don't go showing yourself.
Yeah.
You stay, stay within and then deepfake your all your products. I like it. It's gone full circle then.
It's interesting to be coming to the the Shining sequel, Dr. Sleep, and there is a big mystery about it, about who plays Danny's dad, because Danny's dad is the key figure in the climax of the film, and this is Jack Torrance, played by Jack Nicholson in the original. Now, Danny's mom is not being played by Shelley Duvall. She retired from acting there in Austin some years ago and purportedly has had some mental health problems. But how great would it be if they were able to bring her back? I mean, that's the thing that I go, oh, that's a missed opportunity right there.
Right.
Because the horror of what they went through is kind of etched on Shelley Duvall's feet. Like, you can't separate them from Shelley Duvall.
Yeah, you can't see her. Plus, if you've seen the documentary, how traumatic it was.
Yes, of course. And Scatman Crothers is, of course, deceased. So his Dick Halloran, that character, that's been recast. But nobody has been announced for Jack Torrance. And it's quite probable that it'll be Henry Thomas, because Henry Thomas has worked with this director several times before. And Henry Thomas announced that he was in the movie, but he's not showing up on any of the cast lists. So Henry Thomas, who was the boy in E.T., basically, around the time that Jack Nicholson was terrifying and delighting people in The Shining, him growing up to be Jack Torrance is kind of a fun thing. But there's part of me that wonders, well, might it not be Jack Nicholson? Because it's a ghost character. That's not a spoiler. I mean, if you saw the original, it's not a spoiler. That's the point of the movie. And if you haven't seen the original, you're not going to see a sequel. He's a ghost. And, well, now here's, again, a perfect opportunity to be using deepfake, to be using de-aging technology. Because he hasn't aged. He has stayed exactly the same through all the years. And what a great use of that technology it would be.
Yeah, but I think I read somewhere that his memory may be a little on the fuzz side.
Well, I mean, it's odd because that's why they said he retired. But let's face it, that doesn't necessarily, depending on the role, cause a problem. And he had, after all, signed to play the lead in the American remake of Tony Erdman, a movie that may feature in our Best of the Decade. But and then I found out very quietly, that was about 2016, 2017, and then I found out very quietly that at the end of last year, he dropped out of the project. So you're right, it might be a problem. I expected that if it was going to be a problem, it would really be a problem for a movie like Tony Erdman. I just throw that out there because it does seem like that's the perfect use for that kind of technology.
You know what?
And what about Tarantino's long rumored Star Trek film and his desire to work with Shatner as Captain Kirk?
You think that will happen?
Well, I mean, the problem is that Shatner's not the age that he would need to be. But could Shatner be the age he needs to be?
Yeah, it's true, right? Ha! Well, now I can't wait. I can't wait to see what deepfake does.
You know, speaking of the documentary, I saw another documentary about Kubrick. Not about Kubrick, really. I'm sorry. That's so bad that to say it's about Kubrick, because it's about its subject, its title subject, Film Worker. It's about Leon Vitali, whose only yes. real credit for all the years was as Kubrick's personal assistant. But by God, he had a major role in so many of these films that we love, leaving a thriving acting career as a really talented and successful actor, because he wanted to work at the feet of the master.
Yes.
Did you see this?
I did see this, and it was fascinating, heartbreaking, interesting, and you know, ultimately inspiring about what it is dedicating yourself to something, to an ideal. So, I was also taken aback that he was primarily the acting coach for young Danny in The Shining. That was helpful that there was somebody taking that kid through all that horror. So I
also love that it debunked a couple of myths, right? I mean, it took Room 237, which I always thought is a documentary full of just hooey. Just the ideas are ridiculous. But like so many conspiracy theories, delightful. It's delightful nonsense. But it kind of proves that. But it also disproves another thing, this rumor that Kubrick had no interest in Stephen King's book. And I think that was a rumor that was really started by Stephen King himself. But it's kind of proven in the documentary, no, the book was the basis for all this.
Right.
And Kubrick even spoke fondly of the book and said, okay, you need to read this. Don't you think this will make a movie? But I wanted to ask you about something about the Film Worker. Did this idea of this, you know, this artist who certainly was an artist in his own right as an actor, and certainly seems to me could have been a movie director on his own. When you think of all the different things, he was a casting director on these movies. On Full Metal Jacket, he's the one responsible for Arlie Ermey, for crying out loud, as the drill instructor. He learns photography. He's supervising the color correction on all these movies. I mean, he learns every aspect of filmmaking. He could have been a filmmaker himself. But is there, in fine art, in the long history, especially in Europe, of art, is there a parallel to this of people sacrificing their own individual expression for the purposes of getting to work with masters?
Yeah, there's a couple. The one that immediately falls to mind is, of course, Auguste Rodin, the great sculptor, mentored a young woman whom invariably they had an affair, drove her mad, and then cast her aside. She lived till the 1945 in Paris, and even during the flood of 1937, she thought Rodin was sending the water after her. So, you know, she was a gifted sculptress herself. Some of her work still survives. And that's the one that I immediately thought of in terms of somebody driving you nuts, somebody calling you at all hours of the night, somebody, basically taking your personal life and your work life and not separating the two. So in the painting world, I would be a little, it would take me a little more research, because the one who calls it mine, Peter Paul Rubens, of course, had many assistants who then went on to be quite renowned painters of their own right, without scarring, without any sort of terrible recompense of being involved with him. So Rodin is the only one that's coming to mind.
I want to do a lightning round on a whole bunch of movies, since our hours, our minutes are dwindling. I mentioned last week Captain Marvel versus Shazam, or Captain Marvel versus Captain Marvel, as I persist in calling them. you know, with the Joker coming out, it's fascinating, again, to revisit the DC versus Marvel cinematic universes. As we've explored on this show before, right, DC tried to set up a cinematic universe to rival Marvel, and it really failed. I mean, these Justice League movies, the second Superman movie, I mean, they just lost so much money. And right. the tone was so unremitting and unrelenting. It's like, what the hell were they thinking? And the tone of Marvel movies has really been their strength from movie to movie to movie. You always know, look, this is going to be enjoyable.
Right.
But we have gotten to this point where the tail that was wagging the dog for Marvel movies was how it fits into the cinematic universe, right? Their 5-year plan, their new 5-year plan, their old 5-year plan. Like, how does it fit in with that? And the jigsaw puzzling of all these movies is tiresome. It's tedious. It doesn't mean that the standalone movies are not crafted with care and aren't enjoyable, but you are aware when you're watching them that there is a second game going on that's every bit as important as the game that you are watching, i.e. making a good movie, hopefully, and that is making sure that this good movie fits in to our foolproof plan.
Right.
DC's foolproof plan turned out to prove that they were fools. And what they have done in response, it seems, is breathtaking to me. It is, let's rip up the idea of a cinematic universe. Let's just make movies set in this universe. And you know what? Whatever movie you want to make, make it however you want to make it. And the result is you have, in the same year, a Shazam movie that is so bizarre in its comedic approach, and you have a Joker origin story that is right out of Scorsese Taxi Driver. How do those movies coexist in the same universe? We'll worry about that later. Just make your movie, and it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, because this is also how they do their comic books, right? They give their writers and artists a lot of leeway. Not 100%, of course. You still stay within the confines of some character Bibles, of course, story Bibles. But but if you look at DC comic books themselves, the range in terms of artwork, in terms of tone, in terms of darkened storytelling versus fun storytelling is as diverse as all get out. So I think they're just bringing, I think they realize they can't compete with the juggernaut that is Marvel. And why should they? Because their line has always been the celebration of the artist, not the celebration of the machine.
So Shazam is really kind of satisfying on a way that, Captain Marvel couldn't be. I mean, Shazam explores some themes about family and, you know, it has all the comic book tropes there, you know, in the origin story tropes. Of course it does. But some life is breathed into those by a set of characters and circumstances that we don't see in these movies and by a comedy approach that is really unique to that movie. It made me wish that this whole team was allowed to just make an out-and-out comedy and not an action comedy, but it also is kind of, it captures a bit of why Ghostbusters was such a big hit, why the first Men in Black was such a big hit, that it takes this comedic approach and combines it with awe and wonder. Genuinely innocent awe and wonder. I saw Men in Black International this recently, you know, the fourth Men in Black film. The fourth film.
Fourth what?
Yeah, the third one was quite good. It was a time travel story with Josh Brolin playing, you know, the Tommy Lee Jones character in the past. And I wanted to get to why that was good in a minute. But this one with Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson only can be recommended because of their chemistry and their byplay. They bring the only things that breathe life into this. Not the script, just the way they play it with each other. And sadly, it's not enough. As gifted as they are, as really entertaining as they are, it's not enough. It might be enough on the on a seat back in an airplane. But spending a couple hours in a plane ride with them could be fun. But but you know, the big problem is that these movies, these sequels, the second Men in Black, the fourth Men in Black, the sequels to Ghostbusters, including the reboot. Those ladies are funny. Those ladies are interesting. There was a lot to enjoy about that. But the problem with all these is none of them bring a sense of wonder or awe to this new world, because the world is already known by everyone in the audience and within that world. And so what they replace it with is this hip knowledge of the world.
Cynical.
Men in Black International is hip, and hipness is murder to comedy. It's murder because comedy, you know what, is such a natural, it turns out, for exploring mystery, because comedy can open us with wonder and awe to things.
And,
I mean, isn't a great crafted joke is like a great magic trick, for crying out loud, because you don't see it coming.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you approach something with wonder and wide-eyed, you will see it if it's illogical or it's a unique perspective that no one else has ever thought to look at it before. And that shock in itself will bring laughter.
So that third Men in Black managed to restore some of this, because by making it a time travel story and going back to find the rather surprising origin of a character that you love, you now emotionally get a sense of wonder and awe. And so if with this new Ghostbusters that Jason Reitman, Ivan Reitman's son, is making, how do you re-experience that? And maybe it's by showing the story through the eyes of this new character, this family that has been announced, with Carrie Coon from Fargo playing the mom and the little boy who are rumored to be Egon's family. But you know, you shift the focus so that you can recapture what will open people, because that's what creates in part this magical tone that makes these films so enduringly popular. I want to hit a couple other films real quick. One that is out in theaters that talk about tone, magical tone. One of the most delightful movies anyone will see this year, from directors Tyler Nilsen and Michael Schwartz. It's a movie called The Peanut Butter Falcon.
What?
This is so wonderful. It's an independent film. It stars Shia LaBeouf as a really down on his luck fisherman in the Carolinas, who befriends a Down syndrome young man who has escaped from a care facility. The resources being what they are, there's no state-run care facilities that can handle his needs. So they basically lock him up in a elder care facility where this man in his early 20s spends his time. He makes a break for it. He breaks out. He breaks free. And he makes a run for it. And where he's running for is a wrestling camp that is taught by his favorite villain wrestler in world wrestling. And he knows of this person through one VHS tape that he has played over and over and over again.
Wow. And,
so it's very much a modern kind of a Mark Twain sort of fable. On the river, on the water, as they try to make it to this wrestling camp, these mismatched friends. And it's like I said, the tone is so wonderful, and it deals with a lot of important contemporary issues, as did Mark Twain, right? But what you take away from it is the tone.
Wow. I want to see this one.
So
where do I find it?
It's in theaters everywhere. It's doing quite well, and it's sure to make a lot of top 10 list.
Okay.
Now, a movie in theaters that I recommend everyone avoid and really, honestly, burn down the theaters in order that you don't accidentally see it. A quote-unquote dark comedy called Ready or Not.
Oh, no. I wanted to see that one, too.
I turned off the trailer halfway through because I said I know too much. I don't want to know. You know, a dark comedy is a dark comedy because of the truths it ultimately reveals that are uncomfortable, right? The premise that rich people are really odd, that's not a theme, right? That's, we all know that. We all know that. So your little metaphor of a hide-and-seek game played by rich people, that's, okay, you can start there, but please tell me you're going to deepen into exploring some stuff. No, that's it. That's as good as it gets. So if you really want to enjoy the movie, watch the trailer. Watch the trailer again and again and again and again, and you will have a much more enjoyable experience than the movie. Yeah. It's one of the worst films I've seen in a long, long time.
Really?
I saw two recent releases on video, both of which are quasi-female driven. One is the Jonathan Levine comedy Long Shot, starring Charlize Theron as the Secretary of State, and Seth Rogen as her speechwriter, who they meet cute. They knew each other when they were young. They meet cute. They fall in love. There are obstacles. Will it work out between them? Who fucking cares? What I say a long, long time ago, I say they met on the set of some movie where this kind of comedy approach would work, which means circa 2002, a time from which Seth Rogen's shtick has not evolved at all.
No, I know. However, let's, you know, remind ourselves that studios have to have one rom-com out there at any given time, so they will not be blindsided by not having something in the pipe for the next generation of kids who haven't seen rom-coms.
And they're not gonna go see this one because because the people in it are old, and but even more, the comedy is old. This word is coming up again and again and again. It's in its own way, it's nostalgia porn, and it's literally nostalgia porn in the story because all they can talk about is how great things were in the 90s and making cultural references in the 90s. But with a comedic approach whose sell-by date was 2007. So even its approach is nostalgia porn.
Wow. That is harsh.
Now, another one, an actual remake that is quite delightful and unexpected is Gloria Bell. And this is from filmmaker Sebastian Lelio, who a couple years back made A Fantastic Woman, which won Best Foreign Language Film, and which I raved about. And I got to meet him at a screening where it was basically me and Diane Cannon and him at this screening of A Fantastic Woman. And he talked about there how he was remaking his film Gloria. And he remade it into an English language film starring Julianne Moore. And it is much more of a comedy than the original. But boy, this is a comedy where it's just so surprising because the comedy not only is truly born out of character, but it's born out of the actor playing the character, who is finding these things and exploring these things. And I've never been the hugest Julianne Moore fan. There's some movies of hers that I really, really like. But this is such a great performance. And it's a movie about a woman of a certain age who does not know who she is and has to find herself. It's a coming of age story. And that age is retirement age.
Wow. And it's called
Gloria Bell is the name of it. And I can't recommend this this one enough. And I hope it gets remembered enough. It came through A24 And as we know, they are able to market these things. So I hope that they're able to remind viewers of it enough, because she is certainly, if nothing else, deserving of award consideration at the end of the year for her performance. It's a wonderful comedic performance. And so anyway, so those are some of the quick hits. I want to talk about A24 a bit more next week.
Yes.
Because I was shocked. I finally went through and I looked at their list of all the movies they've released. And there have been, I think, 77 now. And it was just staggering, not only the percentage I've seen, but the percentage that are, like, really... Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, I want to talk about the films of Denis Villeneuve. I want to talk about the films of Abbas Kiarostami. Because these are two filmmakers whose works I've been rewatching as I anticipate putting together my best of the decade list. But I was just dumbfounded at realizing their movies are thematically so similar from movie to movie, even as the genres change so dramatically. And different chapters in the same book, I guess we could say. So I want to do that. And we've got some television stories to share, which will be appropriate because the Emmys are next week. And if that weren't enough to look forward to, and by God, don't you think it ought to be?
It ought to be.
We have a Phantom of the Paradise story and conversation to talk about as we discuss the importance of failure in finding your creative voice.
Wow. Let's do that then.
Next week on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. We're 75 minutes into this. Everybody, if you found this show, you know how to find others. So I'm just going to say, keep finding us. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.